hello and welcome to Cycling Mo, your cycling informant. I have dusted the podcast down. It's been in cold storage for a while, but we had to do this one. I am joined by Jay Thompson to look back at his career after he announced his retirement earlier this week. So Jay, first and foremost, how are you?
David, it's good to be back. It's been a while. It's great that I get to give one last shout out here. Doing all right here in Germany. We're on a little bit of a full lockdown, so I suppose the same as what you guys have in the UK. And yeah, a little bit shitty for the Christmas season, but I guess it is what it is, eh?
It certainly is. But we'll give some people something to listen to, so that'll be good. We're going to dive into the old days. So, growing up as a kid in South Africa, cycling probably wasn't high up on the sporting list for most people. So how did you get into it?
Yeah, to be honest, I actually just played rugby and did athletics and swam, played water polo. I was a kid of a jack of all trades. I liked to do every sport that I could and made sure that I did something. I didn't like sitting in the classroom. So, but in some way, I was always into the Tour de France. If that makes something. It was always an attraction to me. I never really watched any other races, really, to be honest. But throughout schooling years, I always was at home for summer holidays and always watched the Tour de France. And yeah, that's maybe because my dad was always an avid cyclist, and you know, we kind of had a little bit in our blood that cycling was part of us.
How did it come around that you went kind of school to sort of pro? You signed for, what was the first team you signed for?
So the first team I signed for was Dimension Data, actually, from a South African sponsor that was running a feeder team that was for, back then, like an under 23 team for Douglas Ryder's now current NTTE pro cycling team. So yeah, I was in his feeder team 2005.
How did that come about?
Yeah, I started riding kind of just a little bit on here and there on the side, and when I wasn't playing rugby games, I was, or training to play rugby, I was riding the bike, and then started doing some really small races. We had played in Funabale, it used to be called, and I did a couple of little races around there, and yeah, I ended up winning one or two and got attention of some people that were like, okay, well, he has a big boy that used to play rugby, had hairy legs and was winning bike races, and he was young, so let's have a look at him. So yeah, from then I never looked back.
So you bounced around a couple of teams. So Team Konica Minolta, 2007. MTN Energade road team for 2 years. Fly V Australia. What were those early days like? That kind of 2007, 2010. What were those kind of years like?
2007 was horrible. with Konica Minolta, we had a little bit of a European program. So we had a little base in Belgium. We went across in the beginning of May, I think. Then I went to the Tour of Japan with Chris Froome, actually, was my teammate that year, and roommate in Belgium for those 3 months that we lived there. We got back from Japan. First day out on the bike, I hit a girl on the bike path while training, broke my collarbone. Didn't have the money to do an operation, didn't have the good enough insurance to do an operation, so I sat inside the keller like I am now, training and trying to get ready for the last little races that we had in Europe. And then eventually went back to South Africa. I thought I turned things around and started getting into good shape. We were heading off to Tour of Ireland and Tour of Britain. And the morning before I had to take off to fly to the races, I got hit by a car. So 2007, I can tell you, was one I don't like to remember, but I think it also grew me a lot. Yeah. Then 2008, I found a lot of success, you know, on the South African scene. I won Tour of Egypt. Where there, I won three stages and won the overall there. I got to race in Gabon. Didn't win a stage there, but I got second and crashed in a gutter and cut my arm open. But yeah, they were interesting years, but they were years that kind of grew me as a bike rider and got me ready for wanting more. And that's when I made the decision at the end of 2009 that, okay, I'm going to try and race in America. After we raced Super Week there in 2009, I thought, okay, I'll try and make it here and see if this could be a step for me to go to Europe, because to go directly to Europe, I didn't have a door and I couldn't really just afford to go and ride for free in a club somewhere in Belgium just doing criterium. So yeah, I landed up on Flyview Australia, and that was a great year. As a team, we won race after race in America, and it was really great, and it was a good time. But I really wanted to make the next step and go to Europe. And then the team decided that, okay, we're going to go from continental team to world tour in one big step. And yeah, we all signed contracts, and we were all super happy that the next year was going to be in Europe. And yeah, that was with the Pegasus Racing that never left off the ground. So I got a nice Christmas present in 2010, getting told I had no job.
So 2010 was actually, it was a really good year, wasn't it? You won a stage in Tour of Wellington. You won a stage in Langkawi. Those races, obviously, people are looking at them. And then you see somebody like yourself as a young guy, you're winning those races. Did that help kind of get you out there a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. I think winning the stage in Langkawi and also in Wellington, I think I finished also third or fourth on the GC there, considering a big guy like me, not really the best of climbers. So, you know, I think it was more for myself than it was for sponsors and to getting to teams winning there. You know, because a lot of people, they don't see Asia as a big racing, if I can say it like that, put it in quotation marks. But as a young rider, if you can win races there and you can win in Asia, it's a good motivation for yourself to, okay, now I'm ready to take the next step and to go to try it in Europe. I had to wait a little longer till I got my first European experience again. When I went to United Healthcare was, you know, when I made the next step across to Europe in 2012.
So 2011, you signed for Bissell.
Rode for free.
American-based team. Did you live over in America at that point?
Yes, I lived in America for 3 years. So I spent 2010, 11 and 12 there.
And did you say that you rode for free?
2011, I rode for 3 years.
How hard was that?
Yeah, that was really hard. I can tell you, it was not a nice experience. I had a lot of friends and, of course, some family that could try and help me as much as they could, but I wanted to do it myself. I really wanted to be pro and I really wanted to do it. And luckily in 2010, we made a lot of prize money, so I could use a lot of that and maxed out a couple of credit cards. But yeah, you know, I managed to get through the year and keep the dream alive for a little bit longer. So, you know, if I look back at it, it was great. I kept the dream alive for another 10 years. So, if I had to go back to then, I would do it all over again.
What was the pressure like? You know, you're riding for free, you're using up your savings. This is probably, like, I would imagine you probably only had 1 year to do that. You know, that moment of, right, I've got a year to make it or not. What was that kind of, was it pressure?
Let's just say my bad sleeping habits really, really, really started in 2011. Yeah, look, I wasn't over the top and I wasn't crazy and wasn't trying. I was training a fair bit. 7 hours was like a medium day kind of thing. You know what I mean? I had no money, so I could do nothing. Didn't really have money to go and eat out or do anything fun. So I spent most of my time just riding the bike for hours and hours and hours, which is maybe something I would look back and say, I shouldn't have done that. Probably could have been better and not have done that. But when you're in the moment, you're in the moment, and that's the way it goes. But yeah, I only had that 1 year. The thought in my mind was, okay, I've got 1 year. That's all I've got. And if it doesn't happen, then okay, I go back home and that was it. At least I can say I gave it everything I had.
But it did work out. So, end of 2011, going into 2012, you land a contract with United Healthcare, who were Pro Conti at that time. So, you made the move up from continental level to Pro Conti. You did Saint Louis, you did a spell in Belgium, you rode some fairly big races with the team. You won a race, you won a stage in Portugal.
The infamous Volta.
Ooh, that
What was
race.
that? Do you remember your stage win?
Like it was yesterday.
Looking at the results, you seem to win by quite some margin. So I'm thinking late break, early break. What was it?
That was an early break. Me and one other guy. Chopping off for 200 Ks together, thinking, okay, 35 degrees, it is hot as hell. And then suddenly saw the time board came, we had 80 Ks to go or something like that, and it was 12 minutes. And I was like, ooh, there's only one climb, one real big climb left. There's a good chance that I could do this, and I started believing. And I kept on keeping my breakaway partner really motivated. And I said to him, if we just keep going, I promise you we'll stay away. We just have to work together. And we got to the last climb of the day, and holy crap, that thing was steep and filthy. I just remember we were riding up there, and the guy was in the break just said to me he couldn't anymore, and he sat up, and I said, okay, well, I still have 7 minutes. Let me keep going. It's 40 Ks to go. There's a really good chance I can stay away. And yeah, I managed to hold on by a minute and a half, I think, at the end, minute 40 or something like that at the finish. It might have been. Can't remember.
40 seconds.
Ah, 40 seconds. Ah, that was to Hugo Sabido, no?
Oh, what a memory. A minute and five to the next guys, and then it was a minute and nine to the guys after that. And not only did you win the stage, but you took the overall lead.
Yeah, and held it for a few days.
Yeah, held it for a few days as well. What was racing in Portugal like? Obviously, we all know this infamous stories about the Volta. Some dubious goings on over there, but what was the race actually like?
Can tell you when you're in the race, like, okay, for me it was like it was hard. Yeah, sure, but going uphill for me most of the time is hard anyway. So, you know, maybe in Portugal you just got dropped 3 climbs earlier than normal. Yeah, I did Portugal maybe I think 2 or 3 times. Maybe we did it in 2013 again, and the next year I did the Vuelta España, and for me the Vuelta was easier than Portugal. My first Grand Tour was easier than doing Portugal.
That's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
What's this Grand Tour stuff about? Go race in Portugal. That's the real business.
So 2012 obviously was a successful year, yeah? You look back at that as one that was a good learning experience for you.
No, for sure. It was a really good year. I got to race Qinghai Lake that year. You know, that was also an awesome experience for me. I'd never raced at such an altitude before, so that was really awesome. And I've always enjoyed racing in China, so you know, been able to get that, and then also you know, being with the American team, and it was, we had a really good bunch of guys in 2012, so you know, it was a good year for me, and you know, of course, after riding for free and suddenly having a salary, I felt proud.
So then, obviously, MTN Quebeca went Pro Continental 2013. That was their first year Pro Conti. Obviously, you rode for the feeder teams way back in the day. Was it a natural move? How did that come about?
Yeah, to be honest, it was wasn't it. I didn't even question it. You know, when Douglas phoned, he said, "Look, we're hoping to go Pro Continental next year. What do you think?" I said, "Well, if you send me a contract, I'll sign it today and I'll send it back to you." So, you know, I didn't even think about it once. Like, I didn't even question it. So, I had the opportunity to stay at UnitedHealthcare, but yeah, for me, it wasn't even a choice to be in a South African team and also to get the chance to race in Europe. I took it with arms wide open.
How big a deal was it? You know, you've grown up in South Africa, not many kind of South African pros. You've had to move across the world to race. How big a deal was it riding for a South African team, being a South African?
Yeah, it was a big deal. That's why I went all in to win the national champs that year. I really wanted to win to be South African champion. Yeah, it's lucky enough I did. So, you know, 2013 started with a bang and was really good. And then, yeah, of course, being on the start line of Torino Adriatico and then to Milan San Remo as an African team, as a South African champ, first year in the European scene, and you know, it was an unbelievable feeling. You can't really explain the emotion. When the team announced that they keep him going, it for me it was like a relief. Like, oh, thank goodness, you know, it keeps going, it keeps that alive, and keeps people knowing that there's a chance that you can make it from Africa.
How big a deal has it been in Africa, having that team that people can aspire to ride for? Has it made a difference in terms of people thinking, yeah, this is a real kind of prospect, I can turn professional?
No, 100%. You know, of course, it's difficult when you're racing just in South Africa, but the amount of professionals and non-professional people that have taken to the sport in South Africa has definitely increased over the years, and I think a lot to do because of the team. You know, the team has always been in the highlights, and it's always made the news in South Africa, and it's always brought a little bit of attention to itself, you know, and that brings attention to the sport and it brings new people into the sport. And I think the team did an incredible job over the years to keep the media attention in South Africa always on a good level and keep attracting more people. So, you know, I think it was a big deal, and I think it still is a big deal.
And of course, it's been attached to the charitable foundation kind of all the way through. Every year we see these amazing videos of when you go and deliver bikes. You know, most people will watch that, kind of tear up a little bit. What does that feel like when you're delivering the bikes to the young kids?
I think there's not many words that you can actually explain it. You know, some people try and explain it, but you really can't. You know, when you see a kid that's standing in front of you and you know that he maybe only gets one meal a day, or you know, his parents have no money and there's, you know, like they're like almost stuck in a hole. And then this is an opportunity to help them. It's an unbelievable feeling. There's no words that you can really explain.
And it has done a huge amount of good for the foundation, hasn't it? Over the years, they've raised a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah, definitely. You know, the amount of money that the team's been able to raise, and also just the appearance of having Quebec linked with the team. And you know, I think every time we won a race, Quebec could. They didn't even have to read the media to know that we'd won a race, because you saw a spike in the sales of bicycles or bicycle parts or donations towards kids on getting on them on bikes. So, you know, it's the team has really been good for Quebec, but Quebec has also been really good for the team in that sense that it's brought the whole team together on multiple different levels.
Now, you mentioned we're still in 2013, so new team. Pro Conti for the first time. I remember you got selected for Milan San Remo, the team. There was a little bit of why are they here kind of attitude, a bit of kind of snobbery from the European elite, and Chirlet goes and wins the race. Without doubt, looking back at the monuments maybe of the last kind of 10 years, one of the biggest surprises. Iconic race, I'm sure you'll remember it well. What are your memories of that? Of that day.
You really want to know my memory? My biggest memory of that was we restarted and I was absolutely frozen to the bone. I probably should never have restarted, but I really wanted to because of the moment and the race and knowing how good Chuluk was going at that point in time. But we got to the capos and I was completely, couldn't even concentrate anymore in the sense that I was that cold. So I said, okay, I'm done. So the team said, oh, yeah, wait for the broom wagon. They're picking up some guys behind. Just keep riding. Put your hand up. The broom wagon will pick you up. Little did I know that the broom wagon was already full. And, I was pedaling along and had my hand up. And as I was having my hand up, the bus came flying past me at probably at 80 or 100K an hour. And I was on the coast there, not knowing which direction Milan was and which direction San Remo was. I landed up begging multiple taxi drivers to try and get me to the finish of the race because I was just completely so cooked. And eventually I found one guy that wasn't concentrating and I just climbed straight in his car and I said, I'm not getting out. And couldn't speak one word of Italian. He could not speak one word of English. Just pointed at my number and he was just kept on saying, no, 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 no. Then I just said, well, I'm not getting out. I was freezing cold. I had my bike lying in front of his car, so he wasn't going anywhere till he took me somewhere. And yeah, eventually he took me to the finish and the whole time he put it on the radio because obviously he now knows that I was a cyclist. So I was listening to the race on the radio, trying to use my zero Italian to understand what was going on. And I could hear that we still had Tulik in the front. And then we arrived at the finish line at a road that came almost directly 100 meters to go. And I could see the road run in front of us and pretty much watched Gerald sprinting to victory.
What was that night like?
We had to drive back to Lucca. Yeah, we got in the bus and we drove back to Lucca. So yeah, we went for a pizza and then yeah, drove back to Lucca.
And when did you start feeling warm again?
When I went back to South Africa after Coppa Bartoli, because I had a lung infection and was completely dead, so I had to go back home.
What about your own role? Obviously, you joined the team in 2013. You were with them until this season, 2020. How did your role change and develop over those years?
No, in the beginning, I was always an opportunist. I always liked to go in the breakaways. I loved that. You know, for me, even if I knew there wasn't a chance to do it, I'd won enough races that I'd know that it can work sometimes. So, you know, that was, when I was young, that was what I always did. And I enjoyed that. But yeah, as the years got on, you know, you get riders that start winning races, they're coming on the team and that need help or need a team around them. And yeah, I slowly started turning into a guy that, to what I am today and what I was the last years. And yeah, you know, in one way, I think I should have stayed as a breakaway specialist, but would I have really made it as anything? You know, I'm maybe not the best guy for work in the world, but I know I was always reliable. No matter what, I would always be in the same shape and I would always be able to do my job and I would always give everything. And if I didn't feel like I gave everything, I came back to the next race and I made sure that I did a better job and I always wanted to do more. So yeah, my role evolved over the years into being more a worker, but you know, I was proud of what I turned into and what I could do and how I could help guys in the team. And the last year was not ideal. This 2020 was bad for everybody with COVID and everything. But for me, I broke my hand, my elbow, I broke ribs. I hit a car at 75k an hour. You know, for me, I will try and forget 2020 as a racing season. It's, you know, it is what it is and it's done this way, but yeah.
Okay, so from the low of 2020 to your top five moments, what are your own personal top five moments from your career?
Number one would be winning the South African champs and having my dad at the finish line because it was almost, how many years to the day that my dad had won the South African professional road champs, you know, so for me to be there, it was, and him to be there while I was winning it, it was really, really amazing. Number two, probably riding onto the Champs-Élysées in 2018. That's, you know, a highlight for any professional. We all want to ride the Tour de France as much as we say we don't really care. We all want to do it. So, yeah, that was a real big highlight. Another big thing for me was actually winning that stage in Tour of Portugal and being able to wear the yellow jersey for a few days and, you know, knowing how big of a race it was and hearing the rumours of how Volta Portugal was, it was, yeah. And after that, there were just so many. Of course, starting my first Grand Tour in 2014, that was also a big moment. Volta España, team time trial. That was also, you know, But yeah. Oh, now you have
got
to make
one left.
One left. I don't know if it's a good memory or a bad memory, but the year I rode Roubaix from two sectors before Forest of Arenberger punctured and landed up with one guy from Astana. And the two of us rode through and off over cobbles at speeds probably that we could have done a lot faster in training. But we both wanted to get to the velodrome. And for me, riding onto the velodrome, even though I missed time cut, was, yeah, a really like a proud moment, if I could say something like that. I could have given up. I went past the two feed zones in the same time and I could have stopped and I could have got in a car, but rode to the finish. So that was something that I can be proud about. And yeah, my resilience, I could suppose you could say.
So those are the best moments. Now, what about the biggest rows, the biggest fights? You know, we always see the shine that's put on now with the PR spin after the race and everybody's happy with each other. But behind closed doors when nobody's watching, what's some of the biggest arguments you've seen on the team and why? Surely Cavendish must be up there.
Yeah, but I never really saw him actually really explode, to be honest. I'm more of a guy that likes to defuse problems because I know where they go and I know what people say, and I always try and I also get angry and I also get heated up, and sometimes I rather not say things when things are heated, because sometimes I say stupid things and you get, you know. But what is the biggest heated argument I can probably remember? This is quite a difficult one. You know, I've been thinking about it because you asked me a few days ago to think about this. And
still not much for it.
I really don't have one that I can say to you that stands out that I could say, wow, that was a rip-roaring fight about something.
You must have been on such a nice team.
No, it's just also, maybe I'm just oblivious to it. I just ignore it. Maybe I just say, yeah, okay. You go cry about the spilt milk. There's nothing you can do about it. It is what it is. But yeah, I was maybe never on a, maybe sometimes I was the dumb idiot that did something, so they never said anything when... And most bike riders are smaller than me, so they don't say anything when they want to. If they're too angry, they have to be careful.
So, looking back, as on your career as a whole, your life as a cyclist, is it what you thought it would be as that young kid starting out in the world? Did your life as a cyclist turn out how you thought it would?
No, 100 times better than I ever thought.
How come?
Just, I have everything because of cycling. I mean, you know, it shaped me. It made me who I am today. If it wasn't for cycling, I would never be the person that I am. You know, it taught me a lot of things, and I learned a lot of, through all the hardships and the good times, I learned a lot of things that I think will be something good for me for the future while I look for a job. You know, it's... Of course, when you're young, you dream of riding with no feeling in your legs, and you don't think about the days where you suffer. But I probably enjoyed cycling most when I was really hurting. So, you know, the bad days, I suppose, were almost good days for me, in the sense that, like, I'll remember them the most. You don't remember the days where you just rode from A to B and nothing really happened. You didn't feel your legs. You didn't really get involved in the final. You didn't do any job. You don't remember those days good. But the days where your legs really hurt and you really have to suffer to get through a mountain stage, or you have to really suffer to chase a breakaway back, or, you know, those are the days you remember when you... And those are the days that form us and that make us into the people who we are for after cycling. So, you know, I didn't expect cycling to change me like it did and to shape me, and it gave me my beautiful wife and my two beautiful kids. So I would never have imagined that as a 18-year-old when I started cycling.
As you got older and you married and you had children, does it inevitably change you as a cyclist?
Yes and no. You know, I was always one of those guys that was always super motivated. I always trained and I always did my job and I did what I had to do and I knew what I had to do to get to a level. Of course, every year is different. You might have a bad year and people just think, oh yeah, you're not motivated anymore, or you're not, you know, you're too old or whatever. But sometimes it just, you just have a bad year and you just have a bit of bad luck when things just don't go right and can happen for a whole year. So it is what it is. And yeah.
Does it get harder, the going away? I suppose when you're younger and you're flying off to whatever country, staying in hotels, getting your food made for you, all you've got to do is ride your bike. And then you get to a situation where you're leaving the children, especially when they're young. How hard was that?
I can tell you that probably was the hardest thing to do. You know, as anything in cycling, that was the hardest part. It was leaving home. I hated it. I left when our first daughter was born. I left almost less than 2 weeks later. I was gone and on the plane. Where was I? Yeah, I think I was racing Tour of Britain actually just after my daughter was born. You know. And you go there and you think, oh, she's just so small and you've just left her behind. Of course, as in everything, it does get slightly easier. But the longer I was at home, the harder it got to leave to go to a race. But I also knew it was my job and I also knew that I was coming home and, you know, that this wouldn't be forever. It was really shitty when you were gone for 3-4 weeks at a time or... You had to go for multiple times straight after each other and you only came home just to change change clothes in your suitcase and then get in the train and go off to the next race, you know. So I had years like that in 2019 was pretty similar like that. I did the whole Cobblestone Classic, flew home, then flew back to Belgium, did all the Ardennes, flew home and the next morning my wife drove me to the start of Romandy. My wife came and fetched me from Romandy and straight off to Romandy a few days later, went off to the Giro.
How understanding does your wife have to be?
I think your wife has to be more understanding than any other wife in the world, you know. You know, I'm lucky I have a wife that doesn't fight with me too. Didn't fight with me, so it was really good. Now I could go and train and I knew, you know, I could count on her to be there for me. And you know, of course she's also on a limit with kids, you know, when you have two kids running around and each one wants a different amount of attention and it also becomes a lot alone. So you know, I've got a lot of respect for my wife on how she handled the last 4 years without me.
Now, you've looking back at your races, you've mentioned a few already. So Grand Tours, you've done two Vueltas, a Giro and a Tour, so you've done the set. What you mentioned it already, riding down the Champs-Élysées. Just what, can you put into words what riding a Tour de France is like?
Hell of a hard.
Especially when you get sprayed by the police.
Yeah, when you get maced. look, the Tour de France is just a different level and I think everybody knows it. I really loved the panache of the Giro, just how passionate the crowds were and how... You know, just everything about Italy was amazing. France, you just race at a different speed. Everybody's in their best shape of the year. Some guys are probably some of their best shape of their lives. So the speed is just on a different stratosphere. You know, we all saw how fast the guys were going at the Tour de France this year. You know, of course, a lot of guys were more fresher because of not racing so much so they could prioritize their training and be ready for the Tour this year. So I can't imagine how fast it must have been this year.
And the Tour that you did, I remember the stage where you had to go back and ride for Cav. He was struggling in the mountains. I think it was you and one other. And then he obviously realized that he was done and he waved the two of you on. Both of you managed to finish inside the time limit, I think, and then Cavendish rolled over the line and he was out the race. What was that stage like?
That was a difficult day, you know, because I knew what my job was being at the tour, and that was to be with Cav and to do the job. And but in another way, I didn't want to go home. So, you know, and I think he also knew that. So, you know, I have to take my hat off, because it takes a big guy to tell everybody to leave me alone, and I do this alone. Now, I was with Julian Vermont that day, and the two of us did a team time trial, because we were really far away behind the group header when we eventually started going. And I paid the price for it the next day on the Alpe d'Huez stage. Yeah, we were both lucky enough to make it inside the time limit, and we caught the group header at the top of the second last climb, and then up to Val d'Orthonne we were in the group header, so it was okay. But I can tell you the next day, I paid the price for that big effort. It was quite a monstrous effort that we had to make to stay in the race.
And then looking at the classics, you are lucky enough, maybe, I'll say lucky enough, to have done all five monuments. Which one is your favorite?
They've all got something different about them, because, you know, like, Roubaix must be the one that has the biggest feeling about it, the biggest one that makes you the most scared. You know, if there's anything, it makes you the most nervous, it makes you think about it more often than any of the other classics. You know, when I went to Liège twice, it was, I knew I had a job, and I knew I was most probably not going to finish Liège, because, you know, the amount of climbing there is and the size of me and what my job was running into the races. So, you know, Flanders has just got an atmosphere that's beyond any of the other races. No, no other race has the atmosphere of Flanders in the classics. But yeah. It's difficult. Like, of course, Milan San Remo. It's the longest bike race in the world. No one, you know, there's no question about it. So to pick one, I can't just say that one's better than the other. They've all got something that makes them special and brings that attraction to them.
Right. Okay. So I decided that I'm going to make you work for your money. And we're going to do a quiz. Everybody loves a quiz. So this is without warning. This is without preparation. So we'll see how much you sweat now. So I've got a few questions about your career. Let's see how many you get right.
Okay.
So which race have you done the most?
Ooh. What race have I done the most? Probably the Nationals from South Africa.
No, that doesn't count.
Oh.
No Nationals included.
I'm trying to think. What did I do a lot in the last 8 years? Shoulder press, maybe?
Spot on. One from exactly. One. Seven times you raised shoulder press. Question two. How many Flanders did you do?
Four.
Wrong.
Five.
Six.
Did I do six?
Six, yeah.
See, I'm old. I didn't think I did that many.
Okay. Which teammate have you done the most race days with?
Probably Reinhard Jansen van Rensburg.
Not even in the top three.
Oh, okay, now I must think. I did a shit ton with Cav, so for sure he's one of the top three. Him or Bernie?
It's funny because Van Rensburg has the equal number of races, but when you look at race days, he's way down. So you must have done loads of one-day races with him.
Yeah, most probably, yeah.
It's not Cav, it's not Bernie, South African.
South African guy?
Yeah.
In fact, the top two are South African.
Is that Johan and Yaku?
No, you're just rubbish at this, Jay. You give up yet?
South Africans that I've raced that many race days with.
I'll tell you number three. And maybe that will kick start you. So number three is Italian.
Christian Sparagli.
Christian Sparagli, you did 156 race days together.
Jeez. Okay. Well, raced a bit with Christian.
Okay. So 1 and 2. Both South African. As far as I know, neither race anymore.
Hey, I said you're 100, Yaku. When you said South Africans, I knew it was. I had a feeling it was maybe one of those two. I know I did a lot with the other one, so.
You need to give me surnames, man. Surnames.
How many race days did I do with him?
212.
We raced a lot together, and then we still trained a hell of a lot together in Luca.
And Johan van Ziel was 171. And then Spiragli down in 156.
Wow. So Jaco, I did 50 more race days than anybody else I ever did in my career.
Yeah. You got to know him really well.
Yeah, I did.
Right. So I'm going to say that was incorrect. You're 1 out of 3 so far.
1 out of 3?
1 out of 3. You got Sheldepie right, you got Flanders wrong, and you got your teammate question wrong. So number 4, you're winning Langkawi. Which town did you finish in?
Sorry, what was that?
Your win in Langkawi. Which town did you finish in? Come on, this is what people want. This is podcast gold.
The day before, 2 days before Genting, no? I can tell you the hotel that I slept in that night.
Go on, tell us.
Don't want to know what kind of hotel that was. I woke up in the middle of the night and I had it felt like my skin was crawling. And I thought, no, this can't be right. This really, really, really can't be right. So I got up and I took my sheet off the bed and I lay on the floor and slept on the floor that night. So after being in the breakaway for, I think that was also a 200K day, and I was in the breakaway the whole day. Hardly slept. And then the next day was Genting, I think. So I'm like, maybe the day after.
So come on, town name. You're delaying here.
Yeah, I am delaying because I'm trying to think. See, those are things I remember. I remember those things.
I don't think you're getting this.
I can see the map of where we raced, but I just can't see the name. There's a map there in front of me.
I'm going to tell you. Chukka.
Sorry, I can't say that. That was something that was sitting on the tip of my tongue. But yeah, now I know. Now I'll never forget it because now you made me work for it.
But the travel lodge in Chukka is not somewhere anybody wants to go.
No, not to the hotels that we stayed in.
Right, question 5. This, you have to get this one. 2018 Roubaix. You made the breakaway, but you had to pull out of it because of a mechanical. What was wrong? What mechanical did you have?
Of course I remember this. My stupid front derailleur broke off. So I only had a small chain ring.
And it was the day that the brake delay got all the way to the end.
And I felt pretty good that day as well. So that was probably that I can put these up as one of the big disappointments. The biggest if only my mother had balls, then she would have been my father.
Right. Question 6. We're staying with Roubaix, 2017. You finished inside the time limit by how many seconds?
It was less than a minute.
Correct.
But I need a bit more accuracy than that, Dre.
So not 15 or 17 seconds?
Do you know what? I'll give you it. When I checked, it said it was around 16 seconds.
Yeah, I thought it was somewhere around there. Yeah.
So that was the day, I love this story. That was the day, what was it, Cafo de Labra? You watched Greg win on the big screen.
Yeah, correct. I was riding there by myself. People were already gone. And I saw on the big screen, oh yeah, they're finishing. And I did calculations. I was like, I'm going to have to really ride fast now if I'm going to try and make the finish line.
And was that possibly the year after you missed out on the time limit?
Yeah, it was the year after I missed out on the time limit, yeah.
And do you know, does anybody tell you like how long you've got left?
No, when you're that far behind, no one... And you know what? I didn't even have the broom wagon behind me, so there were guys behind me still, so that was the problem. You know, normally when you have the broom wagon, then somebody will say, listen, you're not going to make the time limit, you know, you're ready. But there, They're the only first time I actually realized how far I was behind. I knew I was a long way behind because I was stopped at the crash with Mitch Dock on Forest of Orenburg. So, and then I knew I was a really long way back, like really long way back. But when I saw Greg finishing, I was like, oh, I've still got quite a far way to go, and time limit's only 7% or 5%, or I was like, okay, this is the quick maths I'm doing here while riding. And I was like, okay, I'm going to have to really... Then I just worked out how fast I had to ride an average speed, and I looked at my speedometer, and that's all I watched the whole way to the finish. Whistling and screaming at people to get out the way while I'm trying to ride on the cobbles, because they also were walking on the cobbles. But yeah, it was... That was a good feeling to come to the velodrome and know that I had finished inside the time limit.
Yeah. I love that story. Right, next question. Another easy one, I think. 2013, when you joined MTN Quebec, what was the colour of the jersey?
Yellow and black.
Correct. You're on a roll. You've got three right on the bounce. Here we go. Last question. When you rode with Bissell, you rode with another rider who is currently still in the World Tour. Who is it?
Eric Young.
No. He's not World Tour, is he? No. He's World Tour now. This year.
Patrick Bevan, man.
Paddy Bevan, there we go.
I had to think a little bit. He was a young little spud then. Hey, he was really young. I think he was only 19 that year.
So what did you get? You got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 out of 8.
Ah, not good enough.
Not bad.
Not good enough. Normally I know my own career inside out. But come on, who remembers the name of a small town in the middle of Malaysia?
Well, you remembered the fact that you had to sleep on the floor.
Yeah, but that's easy. I can remember shit like that. I just can't remember the names of towns in the middle of nowhere.
Listen, I've got to make it hard.
That's true. Can't make it too easy, otherwise...
Yeah, who wants to get 8 out of 8? Not me. Right, okay, looking back. So, you've had 4 Grand Tours, 19 monuments. You've had 4 professional wins. We touched on it earlier. You said that cycling's taught you an awful lot. It's made you the person you are. You know, what's the main things? What are the main things that cycling has actually taught you?
Just to perseverance. If you don't keep going, you're never going to come anywhere. Never give up, because there's always a hard moment. There's always a hard time. It doesn't last forever. You know, it's like a race in the crosswinds. Of course, it's hard at the moment, but you might be lucky. The road might turn. Hold on. You know, sometimes you get dropped and then, but tomorrow's another day and you keep fighting and you keep coming back. I think perseverance is for sure the number one thing it taught me.
I like that analogy. That's good. Right, okay. So, obviously this year you got the sad news that you weren't getting a contract. Obviously you wanted to ride on for I don't know how many more years. How tough was that, getting that news that you weren't going to be able to continue?
I was kind of prepared for it, to be totally honest. I always said if the team didn't continue, I was going to retire. I wasn't going to try anywhere else, and I would take it as it is. So I guess when people heard that I was said that, then they thought I was finished. So, you know, they were ready to push me out the door. And at the end of the day, it is what it is. And now I'm prepared for the next step. Don't know what the next step is yet from a job wise. Busy studying some education in business and management through University of Essex. I'm doing some programming, then doing a couple of courses on programming on the side. So hopefully something comes along in the next months, weeks, days that I can have a job next year. But for now, yeah, I'll just keep trying to stick to my motto, perseverance.
What's the uncertainty like? Because obviously you've had so many years as a cyclist, things are kind of mapped out in front of you. How's this period been where you're not entirely sure where you're going next?
Oh, doing something interesting. It, of course, you know, I know where I want to go, so it's not completely wandering in the dark. But of course, I want to be successful, like anybody does in life. You know, none of us want to finish cycling and just say, okay, well, wash my hands of it, and I just want to sit on the side of the road. But you know, for me, I still want to work hard, and I still want to do a lot of things in my life.
Will you still watch cycling?
Yeah, of course. I'll never give up on cycling. I love cycling. Yeah. I wouldn't have done it this long if I didn't love it.
Are you still going out on the bike? Are you still training?
At the moment, not so much. I'm more enjoying just being at home. And to be honest, I'm waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning and going till 5 o'clock in the afternoon every day between the books or behind the computer. So trying to do as much as I can now to try and get as much knowledge to be able to get a job.
And looking back at your career, this will be hard. I've not prepared you for this one either. So if you could sum up your cycling career in 3 words.
Ooh. Pain, joy and happiness.
In that order?
Oh, maybe not. Maybe happiness, pain, joy. It's difficult to say what order, but I think those are 3 words that I could say had a lot of understanding in my thinking of my career.
And there was somebody on Twitter who really was keen to know, what is your favourite Belgian beer?
Oh, Duvel.
Easy?
That's easy. Duvel is easy too. That's a good beer. It tastes good. Drinking a beer now.
Okay, so we've reached the end of the podcast. I'd like to thank Jay for his time. For those who know and have watched a bit about me and Jay, we've done various things on YouTube, podcasts, the website. It's been great getting to know you over the years. Doing the preview show, kind of Paris-Roubaix ones, always fascinating and really enjoyable. The time that you're able to give up to people is great. I know most cycling fans are a big fan of you in terms of how you go about your business and how you represent yourself. So thank you for everything you've given back to us. And I'm sure you'll have a successful career post-cycling as you did pre-cycling.
Thanks very much, David. It's been an honour to be able to be part of it all. And yeah, I'll definitely keep reading your previews and listening to all your podcasts going further.